sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is economist Robert Cherry, author of the new book, Arab Citizens of Israel, How Far Have They Come? We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. So suddenly the U.S. and Israel are over a week into the war with Iran. The Islamic Republic has widened the conflict by attacking the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, even fellow Shiite nation Azerbaijan. As the horrific extremist Shiite Islamist regime grows ever more desperate, they are striking out. They've even attacked fellow terrorism sponsor Qatar and closet ally Turkey. The supreme leader, that is, head murderer, is now dead, to be succeeded apparently by his son, who seems poised to be equally horrible, and the Iran regime's proclamations about destroying its many enemies and its insane attacks on everyone in an effort to blow up the whole Middle East and interdict the flow of oil and gas to the world speaks to a level of true desperation. Iran's next-to-last remaining ally in the region, Hezbollah in Lebanon, also sent missiles tumbling into northern Israel last week and was met with devastating strikes from the Israel Defense Forces. You know, a week ago, Friday night, I preached a sermon at my synagogue, Beit Simcha, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, for Shabbat Zachor, the Sabbath of Remembrance that precedes the Festival of Purim, when Jews in ancient Persia were saved from an evil leader who sought to destroy us all. In that sermon, I traced the long history of those who've sought to wipe Jews from the face of the earth, the damage they've caused us, and their failure to wipe us out. In every generation, this seems to occur, and we are still here, and they are all gone. In my talk, I connected these ancient, medieval, and modern attacks on our people to the current tyranny in Iran, which, of course, is the same country as Persia and has some ethnic continuity with the ancient Persians. I noted that what was then an American military buildup in the eastern Mediterranean and its environs was perhaps indicative of an attempt to finally topple the evil regime that's been murdering its own rebellious citizens en masse for months and has fomented terror worldwide and is responsible for the murder of many Americans, Israelis, and Jews all over the world in the nearly half century of its evil misrule of a once great nation. Members of my congregation came up to me after services and the next day at Shabbat Torah study and morning services and told me that I was a prophet. I was able to predict the future because, of course, that very night, beginning, I think, during my sermon, the American-Israeli joint attack on the Islamist regime in Iran began. "You predicted it all, Rabbi," they said. "It's happening around Purim. Is that irony, intention, or destiny?" Frankly, as the prophet Isaiah says in the Bible, I am not a prophet, nor am I the son of a prophet. I did not know in advance that the attack on Iran would begin that very night, nor that the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who had ruled Iran with an iron fist, enforcing Sharia law with incredible harshness for 37 brutal years, I did not know he would be killed, as would most of the leadership of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, who tortured and murdered any Iranian citizens who dared question their repressive regime. While the apparent intent of the U.S. military mobilization into the region should have been obvious to anybody, the actual attack being carried out so effectively and with full intention, that was not so easy to predict. When I or anyone is asked what the end result of this Iran war will be, and if we answer, well, Take it all with a large shakers full of salt. Of course, nobody knows if this will truly precipitate regime change in Iran or an end to the terrible rule of this extreme form of Islamist oppression. We don't know if Iran will cease using its oil revenue to sponsor terror groups all over the region and the world. We don't even know what the U.S. goals are in this war, frankly. But anyone who's upset that a vile, murderous, theocratic dictator like Khamenei is gone, well, they're a little bit out of their minds. And anybody who protests in support of an Iranian regime that has systematically tortured and murdered women, LGBTQ members of its society, and all potential political opponents and any religious rivals, all while bankrupting a state rich in oil revenue and running out of water at the same time, anybody who's upset about that is profoundly confused about right and wrong. No, we don't know what's going to happen here. Nobody really does. It's not clear if there is any realistically organized opposition to take over, even if this war succeeds in wiping out a substantial part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's control of the Iranian country and society. It's hard to see how even that could be accomplished solely by airstrikes and missiles and drones, or even by Kurdish militias. But severely degrading the nuclear and missile and drone capacity of the madmen in Iran, that's an accomplishment in its own right. The holiday of Purim is over. Israelis continue to have to huddle in bomb shelters and hope that ballistic missiles don't get through and make direct hits. They did, a week or so ago, killing 10 people, including a family, in the basement of the synagogue in Beit Shemesh last week. U.S. military personnel have also died. Things were pretty weird in America already, and war always brings out the weirdest. That execrable anti-Semite Tucker Carlson started claiming that Chabad, drove the U.S. military into this war in order to bring the Messiah and build a third temple on the Temple Mount. Man, that's a conspiracy theory and a bit of a blood libel I hadn't heard before. The smoke of this war has drawn our attention 9 or 10,000 miles away. We hope for the fall of this horrifying Iranian regime. We pray that civilians and innocents are kept out of the maelstrom of destruction that war always brings. How long will this war last? We don't know. It is my hope that it concludes before Passover, now just 3.5 weeks away. Israelis have spent Purim in bomb shelters. We pray our brothers and sisters are able to celebrate this coming festival of freedom freely and openly. To play us in this morning, here's the first of our pre-Passover songs for the coming holiday of Matzah, Maror, and Liberation.
Maharor kohorech shulechan eorech tzafun barech halel nirtzah. Kadesh urecha tzekarepas yachat Magid rachetza, motzi mahatza.
That was the great Israeli-Moroccan singer Yehoram Gaon singing the Simen LeSeder Shel Pesach, the order of the Passover Seder, for Pesach, coming up April 1st. That's the first Seder. April 2nd's the second Seder. You can come to ours at Beit Simcha. First night, April 1st at 6 p.m. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be economics professor Robert Cherry, who has a systematic and analytical way of looking at an important and neglected issue. He's the author of the new book, Arab Citizens of Israel, How Far Have They Come? It's a surprising story. Hear it when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
Passover is the great Jewish festival of freedom. Celebrate this ultimate holiday of liberation with Congregation Beit Simcha's A Seder for Freedom. Led by Rabbi Sam Kohan, you can experience the magic of Pesach's incredible tale of redemption and liberation through songs, stories, poetry, prayer, wine, and fabulous food, which all combine to make this your most memorable Passover yet. It's coming up Wednesday, April 1st at 6 p.m., the first night Passover Seder at Beit Simcha, 12111 North La Cholla at Tangerine. You can sponsor and attend. Go to www.beitsimchatucson.org to sign up now. Rabbi Sam Kohan's Seder is beautiful, inspirational, and meaningful. And of course, the food is delicious. Kosher and kosher for Passover catering by Catalina Caterers includes prime rib, salmon, or vegan portobello mushroom entrees, gefilte fish, chicken soup, or vegetarian matzo ball soup, dry and sweet wine, grape juice, desserts, matzah, and much more, all included. Haggadahs are supplied too. The Beit Simcha Seder usually sells out, so register today at www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's www.beitsimchatucson.org for a fabulous Passover Festival for Freedom.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Robert Cherry is the author of the new book, Arab Citizens of Israel, How Far Have They Come? A retired Brooklyn College economics professor and American Enterprise Institute affiliate. He has a really scientifically based objective look at the situation of the Arab citizens of Israel, often called Arab Israelis. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Well, thanks for having me.
So tell us what prompted you to take this approach to write this book.
Well, I'm a labor economist, and I'm Jewish. What struck me was I began to see about 20 years ago some substantial changes in the way the Israeli government, the Netanyahu governments, were treating Arab citizens. There were all kinds of initiatives that were begun. There was a fairly aggressive affirmative action set of programs. And so I was curious to see how they were working.
So, you know, there's two ways of looking at Arab Israelis. Is it okay to call them Arab Israelis? I mean, that's what I always learned was the right term.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay, because, you know, that includes a substantial number of Muslims. It includes Christians. It includes a variety of other actually smaller Islamic sects and people that are neither. The Arab Israelis are often thought in the West to be second-class citizens of Israel. And I think there's some truth to that. But it's also, so far as I know, a fact that economically, Arab Israelis have done substantially better than many of the Arabs in other parts of the non-oil-rich Arab world. Is that a correct sense or not?
Let me just speak to that for a moment. They are doing better compared to Jewish Israelis.
Wow.
Than Palestinian living in Lebanon or Jordan compared to the citizens there. Because in Lebanon, they're stateless, and about half of the Palestinian refugees in Jordan are stateless. And those stateless Palestinians are in incredibly deplorable conditions in those countries. And they're in deplorable conditions because the leaders say that if we integrated those refugees, there would no longer be the demand for a right of return on Israel. So to keep alive the right of return, they're subjugating refugees to deplorable conditions.
Now, this has been going on really since 1948. The Egyptians did it, the Jordanians did it, and as you noted, Lebanese and other countries have certainly not treated the Palestinians very well. And in Jordan, they represent 75 to 80% of the population. But let's talk about the economic situation. What did your data show about what has changed for Arab Israelis in Israel?
What happened was that there was a constellation of reasons. One reason was they have a social safety net program, and if you have a lot of poor people, it's costly. So there was a certain desire to reduce social welfare costs. Secondly, they wanted to join the OEDC, European-led Alliance on Economic Issues, and they were required to do something about the inequality. You also had high-tech people that said, we want to have the largest pool of workers possible. So an educated Arab population is good for us. And finally, you had a traditional revisionist Zionist belief, Jabotinsky, that Israel, while it's a Zionist state, on an individual basis, Arabs should have equal opportunity to Jews. And there's a core of revisionist Zionists, particularly Naftali Bennett, who genuinely believed that. And so, for example, Bennett was instrumental in moving government support for integrating Arabs into the high-tech sector. So they're in the high-tech sector where Nazareth is a hub for high-tech. Nazareth is an Arab city. You right. have about 25% of the doctors in Israel are Arab, a third of the nurses, 50% of the pharmacists. So you have a movement upward, not just of a working class into middle class, but professional. In a professional way, there's been substantial advancements.
We will talk much more with our guest this morning on Two Jewish, Robert Cherry, about the status of Israeli Arabs, Israel's Arab citizens, and just what has changed over the course of recent years. When we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age kids and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events include Friday night services every week, 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat available in person in our Facebook page. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m. with Torah reading, always followed by a tasty Kiddush led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. And our services are all available there, too. Our Adult Education Academy classes are taught in person and on Zoom. You can access those by going to the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, taught live and on Zoom in all of our services in person and Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you've got a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes stores, very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish where you hear us. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, we both spent time in Australia. I lived and worked there for 4 months. I've been there several times. You've been there a number of times. There are big protests going on now in Australia because Yitzhak Herzog, the president of Israel, is visiting. And even after the Bondi massacre, there's all kinds of huge pro-Palestinian protests going on. When I lived in Australia, didn't experience anti-Semitism, nobody talked about anti-Zionism, but boy, it's a big issue now.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the president of Israel because the event I attended at the Jay last night, One of the speakers claimed that Israel had no president, only a prime minister. And she was Israeli.
Shimon Peres was a very... I mean, there have been a lot of prominent Israeli presidents. That's silly. Okay, Ezer Weitzman. I mean, very famous people who had prominent roles. They do have a president, even though the head of state is the prime... Or the head of government is the prime minister. The president is the, ceremonial head.
So back to Australia. Australia is a very, very complicated country that Americans like to oversimplify and think of in terms of like the outback and kangaroos and the koalas and whatever. But first of all, let's start with one big difference between Australia and the United States. They're roughly similar in size if you actually look at the map and
their
mileage and whatever. Yeah. But Australia has like a tenth the population of the U.S.
Less. It's like 20 to 25 million and we're 340 million. Right.
So less than a tenth.
Right.
That's an important difference. Australia still has a sense of being an open frontier and there's a lot of unsettled land. And they have therefore over their whole history actually, been very welcoming to immigrants. Now the result is now there's an uneasy mix of immigrants from all over the place, particularly the poorer countries in the southern tier of Europe, like Greece and Italy, and a lot of Asian countries, China, Vietnam, Thailand.
Indonesia, all over, sure.
Right. And there's a lot of Asians there now. The result is that Australians are sometimes questioning their national identity or their sense of unity because the population has grown so diverse. And, of course, they've always had Jews. And there were traditionally good relationships between Jews and non-Jews in Australia until, I think, I mean, this is my interpretation, solely personal, no institutional affiliation here, until Israel gave up on Hasbara, which is literally explanation, effectively it's propaganda. You know, up to and including the Six-Day War, Israel had a very good propaganda machine, which worked on the image of Israel throughout the world, and especially in countries where there was a Jewish diaspora. Then, when the Yom Kippur War came along, Israel basically threw in the towel and ceded the whole propaganda arena to the Arabs, who, granted, have more money. But they've been much more seriously engaged at this than the Jewish Israelis for at least 50 years. And the results are showing. I mean, there's like very little understanding in much of the world about the basics of Israeli society. People think of Israel as an armed camp, an apartheid state, all these wildly distorted notions. And if there's nobody to contest those notions, if there's no alternative version presented, those versions will prevail. And I think that's a little bit what's been happening in Australia. And I don't know the percentages for Australia, but I've read that in a country like Ireland, which is, after all, part of Europe, sort of, only 30% of the population is aware that the Holocaust happened at all.
Yeah, it's troubling, and I think Australia is now beginning to act against anti-Semitism, even the Labor government, but it's, you know, it's really catching up from behind. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A synagogue, a Catholic cathedral, and a Protestant church are all on the same street. All of them are very proud of their clergy, and the congregations are more than a little bit competitive. So when the diocese buys the priest a new Cadillac, the church gets the minister a new Lexus. Not to be outdone, the temple board goes and buys the rabbi a brand new Lincoln. One morning, the three clergymen are all leaving at the same time. The rabbi and the minister notice the priests out there with some incense and holy water and people from the parish, and they're blessing the new Cadillac. The minister sees this, gathers the vestry quickly, and they pour a whole bucket of water over the Lexus in order to christen it. The rabbi is perplexed for a moment. Then he goes into the temple, out the back into a shed, grabs something, comes out with a hacksaw, and cuts 3 inches off the tailpipe of the Lincoln. You see, he gave the car a bris. Never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a classic. A special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Hope is a tangible, unstated presence in our portion this week, Vayakhel Pekudei, the double sedra at the end of the book of Exodus. On the surface, this portion is nothing more than a listing of how the tabernacle in the wilderness was constructed by our ancestors. Lists of materials used, processes employed, structures and implements assembled. So many pieces of this kind of wood or gold or skins of animals used to make this item. These artisans must be employed on that project. Moses asked for these materials and they were graciously donated and so on. But in another sense, this is an incredibly hopeful Torah portion, a section that represents the triumph of hope over experience. For in last week's Torah portion of Ki Tisah, the people of Israel dramatically failed both God and Moses. They made a golden calf and worshipped it, bowed before it, insisted it was their God. Just 40 days after receiving the Ten Commandments at Sinai, they forgot the revelation and abandoned monotheism and morality and everything they'd just been taught, including the second commandment against worshiping idols. It was a devastating moment for Moses. It must have been a fundamentally depressing time for even God. And yet, just a few passages later, we find God instructing Moses to build a tabernacle, a permanent home for the Shekhinah, the divine presence, right in the midst of these same rotten people. Those people, the Israelites, our ancestors, have just proven they are not worthy. Yet God immediately gives them a place, no, insists that they create a space that will be a constant and permanent reminder God will always be with them and never abandon them. Seems like a reward for treachery, right? No, actually it's a promise of hope. For if God will dwell among them, asuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham, we are told in the earlier Torah portion of Truma, build me a sanctuary and I will dwell among you. Well, that's a pledge that things can always be made good, that losses can in some sense or another be replaced, that we are always able to return to come into grace and blessing again. This juxtapositioning is important. This portion's placement between the betrayal of the golden calf and the blessing of the brand spanking new tabernacle, the model for every temple thereafter in Jewish history, is a promise and pledge of hope. You probably know the Hebrew word for hope, tikvah, from the national anthem of Israel, ha-tikvah. But for me, tikvah is a promise from God that even after our worst moments, even in our depths of despair or failure, we can return to holiness and goodness. God will be present for us then, if we come back, and will be among us. So may it always prove to be. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, social economist Robert Cherry, explains just how the Arab Israelis have fared in recent years and why that presents a case for hope for the future. His new book is called Arab Citizens of Israel, How Far Have They Come? And it will be a fascinating conversation when we come back in just a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
A Toronto synagogue was hit by gunfire late on Purim night, just hours after the Purim celebration there. No injuries took place. The shooting targeted Reform Synagogue Temple Emmanuel in Toronto. It happened about 10:49 p.m. That Purim event of a sing-along spiel and costume contest ended a couple hours before. Rabbi Deborah Landsberg said she couldn't sleep that night. She was still inside the temple when the shooting occurred. She heard about 20 gunshots. I'm shaken, she said. It is devastating that there are those in this society who want to shatter what we have here. The shooting is the latest in a string of crimes targeting Jewish institutions and residents in Toronto, Canada. A Jewish girls' elementary school was hit by gunfire three times in 2024. Last December, mezuzahs were torn from residents' doorposts in multiple buildings, including a senior residence. And a month before, a suspect damaged the outer glass windows of Kehilat Sharei Torah, a synagogue close to Temple Emmanuel in Toronto. So far this year, anti-Jewish hate crimes make up 63% of all reported hate crimes in Toronto, according to Deputy Chief Johnson of Toronto's Police Department. That continues a trend of increased anti-Semitic crimes in Canada since October 7, 2023. These numbers are not abstract. They represent real people and real harm, the deputy chief said. A trove of sacred Jewish objects from Greece stolen by the Nazis and displaced for decades in Poland is finally heading back home in 2026. Poland returned 91 religious and ceremonial artifacts to the Greek government at a ceremony in Warsaw last week. Among them were Torah scrolls, a Torah mantle, silver finials, that's the silver pieces you put on as crowns, fragments of a rich Greek-Jewish heritage that was nearly wiped out by the Nazis. This marks the first time Poland has repatriated cultural property held under its care, illegally taken from another country. May it be a good precedent. Rabbi Andrea Weiss, associate editor with Professor Tamara Eskenazi of the Popular Women's Torah Commentary, for which she shared a National Jewish Book Award, at the provost of Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles, died of cancer at the early age of 60 last week. Andrea Weiss's death is another blow for the leadership of the Reform movement. It has buried two leaders of Hebrew Union College who died prematurely during Weiss's tenure, Rabbi Aaron Pankin, then the seminary's president, who died in a plane crash in 2018, and Rabbi David Ellenson, its past president, in 2023, and chancellor. Both were past guests of Two Jewish and personal friends of mine. Rabbi Ellenson was a mentor of mine. The Reform School of Sacred Music, too, is named for Debbie Friedman, who died prematurely at the age of 59 in 2011. Rabbi Andrea Weiss was an outstanding Bible scholar and a pioneer in female leadership at Hebrew Union College. Her early death is a great and sad loss.
You tell me that you're leaving. I can't believe it's true. Girl, there's just no living without you.
Neil Sedaka, another past guest of Two Jewish, composer of more than 500 songs over a 70-year career in the music business, both written for himself and for a plethora of other recording artists. Neil Sedaka passed away last week at the age of 86.
Don't you leave my heart in me.
He was a huge success in his teens and early 20s, but became a has-been almost immediately thereafter, and then managed one of the great comebacks in popular music history. Sedaka, whose father was the son of Sephardic immigrants from Turkey and whose mother was an Ashkenazi Jew, made an indelible mark on the music world during his long, long career. As a heartthrob in his teens and early 20s, he had hits like Calendar Girl, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Oh Carol. That one was inspired by his high school girlfriend, Carol Klein, who later changed her name to Carol King, recording artist. In the 70s, with help from Elton John, Sedaka made his return to the music scene, wrote some of his greatest hits, including the number one single, Laughter in the Rain. He also wrote one of his most successful songs of all time, Captain and Tennille's Love Will Keep Us Together. That was the number one song of the whole year in the whole world in 1975. Sorry, I just can't bring myself to play Captain and Tennille. Anyway, Sedaka was raised in a tight-knit Jewish home in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. He said, "We were 11 people in a two-bedroom apartment, my grandparents, five aunts, my parents, my sister, and me sharing one bathroom. But I was very spoiled by all those ladies. It was a wonderful, wonderful childhood." He was 8 years old when he fell in love with the piano. His mother took a job at the department store to help afford a piano. His father, a cab driver, worked to send his son to Juilliard's prep school. Sedaka later took his dad with him whenever he toured the world. There's a fun story in an interview Sedaka did about Laughter in the Rain, and it involves Billy Joel.
Billy Joel came to me one day in a restaurant. He said, "I have to tell you the funniest story. I got up in the middle of the night, I wrote this great tune, and I called my musicians to come to my apartment at 3 a.m. They said, Billy Joel is calling us at 3 a.m., he's crazy. And he said, I want you to hear this tune. Da 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 da. They said, it's good, but it's Neil Sedaka's Laughter in the Rain. He said, oh, unconsciously, I copied it. And it was a great form of flattery. And then he had Mrs. O'Leary's grocery store, da na 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 for a penny. And then he had to change it to Mrs. O'Leary's grocery store.
Moving out.
Na 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 na, moving out.
For someday, when my mama Leo
Yil Sedaka, who started his career prolifically writing songs in the legendary Brill Building in New York, had hits with artists ranging from Connie Francis to The Carpenters to ABBA to 10cc. I had the pleasure of interviewing Sedaka when he recorded a Yiddish language album of favorites. He was a kind and generous and gracious man. You should expect that of a person named Sedaka, the Hebrew word for charity. Lech l'shalom, Neil. Your songs will live on forever. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Robert Cherry, who's a labor economist and has written a really interesting new book about the status of Arab Israeli citizens. It's called, not surprisingly, Arab Citizens of Israel. How far have they come? So tell us a little bit about the starting point, because how far they've come means they had to start somewhere. Tell us what the situation was at the beginning of this study.
Well, the study begins actually with the first Aliyah, Jewish Aliyah in 1882, and goes up through the present. But I think where the comparison is most pronounced is that after independence, it was pretty harsh experience for Arab citizens of Israel. They were under military rule for various reasons. A substantial amount of their land was confiscated. Part of it was to settle the Mizrahi Jews who were being expelled from Arab countries, 800,000 of them. But that didn't matter if you were an Israeli Arab. Your land was being taken, and you were sitting in villages where you needed to get permission to leave, to go work somewhere, to visit. So it's a
pretty rough situation.
And that lasts for about 20 years. One of the reasons was there was no Palestinian movement. Palestine was made up in 1920 as part of the British Mandate. So there was no kind of indigenous notion of being Palestinian. And secondly, all of the educated class, all of the business class, all of the professionals left in 1948. So that the Palestinians or Arab citizens were reduced to traditional village life where their village leaders were of a traditional nature. They individually negotiated with the state. So it was they had no power. So that's what we start out with. And that changes in the 70s and 80s, both because you begin to get a new leadership of young, educated professionals, and you begin to get the state fulfilling basic responsibilities of education, occupational training, and the like. So you begin to have the semblance of Arabs moving, but still an incredibly unequal situation. It's not until after the Second Intifada that you have the government being serious about the changes, what I spoke about a little while ago. They had reasons for making those changes. But it was after the Second Intifada, which had a devastating effect on Arab citizens, because during the Intifada, construction collapsed, tourism collapsed, and that was the two major industries that employs Arab citizens. So the gap between Jews and Arabs grew substantially. And it was creating an untenable situation. But as I began briefly before, starting in 2008, 2009, you begin to see sustained efforts that have been highly successful. And they've been successful enough that when this war broke out, this IDF-Hamas war, there was overwhelming support among Arab citizens for the Israeli forces. 86% of Israeli Arabs were willing to help with civilian efforts. 58% said the war increased shared destiny between Arabs and Jews. There was no violence in the mixed cities, unlike 2 years earlier when there was the last Gaza war in 2021, there was violence in those cities because there was cooperation between both Muslim and Jewish leaders. So it's a world of difference in 2025 from 1955.
It should be noted that Israeli Arabs are not required to serve in the Israeli military. Are they permitted to do so?
Well, they are permitted. And actually, I wouldn't want to overstate it, but there has been a substantial increase in the number of Arab citizens joining the military. What they have, however, is they have an option of basically to do civilian services, which give them the equivalent of the benefits that you get for being in the army, so that you have like 10,000 young Arabs, primarily women, but young Arabs doing this civil service. It often is in their own villages where they supplement government services in a variety of ways. And that's been very successful.
Anecdotally, I remember visiting Abu Ghosh, which is kind of between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, really outside, but it has a reputation for having the best hummus or the best falafel, depending on, like, everybody. And everybody in Israel argues this point, but it definitely has some of the best falafel in the whole state. Remember, we stopped there. It's an Arab village, and I've magnificent homes and a level of economic prosperity that I don't think, when we went there, this is some years back, not forever, that any of us realized that some Arab citizens of Israel are doing very well indeed. Besides the, you know, obviously making falafel and great hummus is not the same thing as high tech, but like around Nazareth. But was there some of this going on even before these initiatives of the Netanyahu government?
You know, after this talk, I'm going to Schlesinger's for a pastrami sandwich, so I can relate to food.
You are Jewish. So, it's pretty clear.
Well, you know, as I mentioned, there's in the high tech and in the medical areas real advances. But in education, you have a tricky situation. 35% of Arab women have a bachelor's degree, but they have it in education overwhelmingly. And so if they only would be teaching in Arab schools, it would be limited. But what has happened in the last decade is there's been a concerted effort, again spearheaded by Bennett, to have Arab teachers in Jewish schools, and not simply to teach Arabic, but to teach subject matter. And there's well over 1,000 teachers. A decade ago, there were maybe 100, 150 exclusively teaching Arabic. Now there's well over 1,000 who are in Jewish schools teaching all kinds of subject matter. So that's been an important area, again, for women, Arab women. As in this country, there's a serious problem of Arab young men. So while it's 35% of Arab women, it's like 15% of our young Arab men go on from grade school. And there are real attempts by the government. There's a gap year now where a year after they graduate high school, there's coordinated efforts to help them figure out what they're going to be doing with their lives. And that's paid. In other words, people in the gap year get paid.
You noted that in this recent Gaza war that began October 7, 2023, the Israeli Arabs showed great support on a civilian level, volunteering, doing all kinds of things to support the war effort against Hamas. In the second Intifada, some Israeli Arabs actually were involved in doing terrorism, which was a shock, I think, to a lot of Israelis. Something definitely has changed attitudinally. Is that, could you understand that from the economics of it?
Well, I mean, what's changed is what I've described is their position in society. After all, in the Bennett government, they had a position. You know, Ram Party was part of the ruling coalition. In East Jerusalem, you have real efforts at improving the quality in East Jerusalem, employment opportunities, And so now you have a situation where recent polls have consistently found that if East Jerusalem Palestinians had to choose, they choose Israeli citizenship over, you know, citizenship in a Palestinian state. So, you know, these things count. 70% of Arab citizens want the Arab parties to be part of the next government. You know, they want further integration. And so I'd like to be hopeful.
I appreciate you being hopeful. So how can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about your book about Arab Israelis?
The book has just been released on Amazon. It's only available on Amazon because the publisher has a deal with them. If you go to muckrake.com, you can see the articles I've written over the last few years on this topic and other things.
Thank you again for a great visit. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
Passover is the great Jewish festival of freedom. Celebrate this ultimate holiday of liberation with Congregation Beit Simcha's A Seder for Freedom. Led by Rabbi Sam Kohan, you can experience the magic of Pesach's incredible tale of redemption and liberation through songs, stories, poetry, prayer, wine, and fabulous food, which all combine to make this your most memorable Passover yet. It's coming up Wednesday, April 1st at 6 p.m., the first night Passover Seder at Beit Simcha, 12111 North La Cholla at Tangerine. You can sponsor and attend. Go to www.beitsimchatucson.org to sign up now. Rabbi Sam Kohan's Seder is beautiful, inspirational, and meaningful. And of course, the food is delicious. Kosher and kosher for Passover catering by Catalina Caterers includes prime rib, salmon, or vegan portobello mushroom entrees, gefilte fish, chicken soup, or vegetarian matzo ball soup, dry and sweet wine, grape juice, desserts, matzah, and much more, all included. Haggadahs are supplied too. The Beit Simcha Seder usually sells out, so register today at www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's www.beitsimchatucson.org for a fabulous Passover Festival for Freedom.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Zeva Bukai, author of The Anatomy of Exile, a National Jewish Book Award winner for debut fiction, Book of the Year. And join us at Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from cantor Alberto Mizrahi, a past guest of Too Jewish. It's Moshe Osher's great Chad Gadyah for the end of the Passover Seder. It's coming up April 1st. Come to ours. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Chad Gadyah.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
I got your car.